en podcast från Aftonbladet Ledare.
Välkommen till Startafesterna. Idag ska vi prata med den amerikanska ekonomen Erin Dubey om arbetsmarknaden, vad som är fel med arbetsmarknaden och vad man kan göra för att rätta till de här felen. Hur ska man få upp lönerna? Och en sak som vi är väldigt bra på här i Sverige, det är ju att vi har starka fack som förhandlar upp lönerna. Men någonting vi saknar i Sverige som amerikanerna har varit bättre på är den makroekonomiska politiken, att man har en expansiv makroekonomisk politik är också viktigt för att få upp lönerna. Och jag ska prata om de här två sakerna idag med min gäst Erin Dubey. Welcome, Erin Dubey. You're a professor of economics at Amherst, Massachusetts, right?
Yep.
And you're here in Sweden now. So tell me, why are you here?
So I'm here actually to give two lectures on a topic that is relevant for this conversation. It's on minimum wages. And so I gave the talks at Uppsala and Stockholm University, and also talking a little bit about a book that I have written.
That's right. You've written the book, The Wage Standard, What's Wrong in the Labor Market and How to Fix It.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so it's really trying to aim to be a conversation that's broader because, you know, in most of my writing, I'm mostly talking to other economists, but these are important topics as we're having this conversation. And so this book is my attempt to sort of broaden that conversation about how are wages set and what can we do better?
Yes, that's very much in line with what we try to do here, sort of bring that conversation down from the ivory tower and onto the streets and to the parliaments. So that people who are affected by these policies, because there are policies involved that determine the wage, even though it doesn't seem like it always, that they understand what's going on or why their wages aren't rising as they should.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the key theme in my book is that, you know, we have a lot of choices. We make choices that determine what the wages are. And those choices are different. Like, you have made certain choices here in Sweden. We have made some choices in America. And some are good, some are not as great. And what can we learn from that? And how can we do better? And that is really the key question that I try to tackle.
Yes, and these choices are made on many different levels also in society. They're made at the firm level. Some companies high wages, some pay low wages. But also in the way we handle wage negotiations, if we do it centrally with unions and employers sitting down and talking, or if we do it decentralized. But also, of course, at the political level, at the level of fiscal policy and monetary policy, how the interest rate is set, how big the state budget is, where you spend money, all of these things affect wages, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So we have all of those levels, the sort of what I call the micro, and then the sort of the middle or the meso level, and then all the way to the macro level. So understanding that whole suite of policies is really critical.
Mm-hmm. So let's start at the micro level.
Yeah.
What determines if wages are high or low at the micro level?
Yeah. So, you know, in many ways, in economics, we sort of think about, well, there's supply and demand. And those are important factors. But it turns out the labor market doesn't just work that way, that employers actually have a degree of choice, a degree of power of what kind of wage strategy to pursue. So in economics, there's a funny name for it. It's called monopsony. Mm. But the idea is really simple. The idea is that, again, a company could pursue a high wage strategy. There's a few things that's going to happen if you do that. For example, you're going to have an easier time recruiting workers, keeping them around, and they may actually work harder. Mm. And all of that gives you some positive benefits that could offset the higher cost of higher wages. Or you could pursue a low wage strategy. Well, you save labor costs, but you're going to have some more turnover. You're going to have possibly lower productivity. And so then you, as a firm, are sort of choosing what kind of strategy to pursue. And this just turns out to have really very important implications, that in such a world where firms are sort of choosing what kind of strategy to pursue, that all kinds of different things can actually happen. So in my book, I sort of talk about how the arc of that has changed, especially in the American context, where we have seen different types of new generations of companies come about in the 80s and 90s that really sort of move towards a low wage strategy. There's a particularly interesting example that it turns out that when companies move to having a CEO who had a business school degree, they started to pay less, about 6% less overall, 9% less to blue collar workers.
You got to maximize shareholder value, right?
Exactly. So, and that's exactly it. So this was something that really in the 70s and 80s became the dominant sort of business perspective, ideology, that shareholder value maximization is the critical thing. Well, when you hire people who are, that's literally what they learned in their classrooms, they're going to implement that. And so you may think, well, maybe it made the companies work better. And it turns out, not so much. Productivity didn't change at all. What changed was lower wages, higher profits, and higher CEO compensation. So just a pure transfer. Mm. And here's the really interesting thing. This was in the United States, but actually turns out exactly the same findings also in Denmark, much closer to home here. Mm. And so these are sort of some of the things that can really, at the micro level, we're talking about companies choosing strategies that really has important implications in many contexts.
Mm. And this is interesting because a lot of people would think that companies, they have to maximize profits, and there's only one way of doing it. They're going to set the wage that will maximize profits. And right. I think people, even on the left, would assume, a lot of Marxists perhaps would think that there's only one way to maximize profits. There's a supply curve and a demand curve, and if you're not exactly on that curve, you're going out of business. So there's only one way to do it. But what you're saying is that there are actually different ways of doing it.
That's right. Yeah. And one of the things that comes out of understanding that there's a degree of wage setting power or monopsony power is that there's a range of strategies that could be roughly similar in terms of profits. A company, actually a major American company, raised its wage. So one interesting thing that's happened in the 2010s is there was a lot of popular pressure on companies to actually raise wages. In the United States, we've had very large increase in inequality, and particularly the bottom wages have not kept up. And we'll come back to this, an interesting contrast in some ways with Sweden. But because of these pressures, major companies, starting with Gap, the retailer, and then Walmart and Target, other major retailers, and then Amazon, instituted voluntary minimum wages. Mm. Like, for example, $15 an hour. This was very new. We didn't have this in America before. It turns out one major logistics company that did this found that its profit didn't fall at all, because the compensating reduction in turnover and the increase in productivity fully paid for itself. Now, if it could pay for itself, so the profits didn't fall, but the company doesn't care one way or another, right? Like, same profit. Not a big deal for the company, but a huge deal for the workers. Because of course, the workers would rather have the high wage strategy. So I think, yes, even people on the left, I think sometimes sort of think this is inevitable. The capitalism is going to do this, but there are actually many varieties of capitalism. And even within a capitalist market, there are different strategies and possibilities that can actually lead to similar performance, but with different distributional outcomes.
Mm. And this, I mean, there are some historical precedents, right? We think of Ford, Henry Ford, when he he had this efficiency wage, if you would call it that.
Yeah.
He decided that it was too much hassle to have these workers come in and then quit after a few days, and he had to hire new ones, and the morale was really low. They weren't working hard as they should. So he decided to pay them a lot, pay them like, I don't know, $5 a day or
$5
something.
$5 a day. That was, you know, sounds low today, but of course, adjusted for inflation, it's much higher. And what's interesting is that was always pretty much the example that we gave until about 2014 or so, with popular pressure and a tightening labor market. We're going to come back to that.
Yes.
We saw companies institute similar things for the first time in like almost 100 years. And so this was really important. So as I lay out in the book, about, you know, 3 to 4 million workers in the United States saw very, you know, clear increases in pay from this sort of set of large companies pursuing a high wage strategy. And we've talked about this for a while, that, you know, there are high, we call the high road strategy versus low road. And this was actually something that happened, and we saw some of the benefits from it. Having said that, it also highlights both the possibilities and the limitations of the pure micro strategy. 3 to 4 million is a lot of workers, but there's, you know, almost 150 million workers in the United States. So one could wonder, like, did it lead to spillover effects? Like, other companies also started doing that, was pretty limited.
Mm-hmm.
And so this sort of also highlighted that this was a good start, but to go further, you need to take it to the next level.
That's right. There can be companies that pursue the high wage strategy, but there's nothing really that stops companies from pursuing the low wage strategy if they want to, because that's also profitable. So what you're arguing, I think, is that we need something to sort of, some kind of countervailing power to force companies, to push companies to take the high wage strategy. So making, shutting off the road to that low wage road.
Shutting off the low road, exactly. And so historically, we have had a few different ways of doing that. One has been the most important one, the presence of labor unions.
Mm.
And so in the United States, you know, we saw a big increase in unionization in the 1930s and 40s, United States, but also a lot of parts of the world, high income countries. That really created a post-war wage standard that lasted for decades. This really built the middle class in America. It made sure that wages and productivity grew together, and wages for bottom and the top sort of grew broadly when productivity rose. So that model worked, but it's basically stopped working after 1980 or so, where we saw really big spread in the wages. The high wages grew a lot faster than bottom wages, and wages stopped tracking productivity as well. So why did that happen? Of course, there are different reasons, but one of them is declining unionization. Today in the, you know, in the US, about 10% or so of the workforce is unionized. But unlike some of our European peer countries, that also means only about 10% of jobs are covered by a union negotiated wage. Mm. And that has led to basically the erosion of the wage standard. We called it sort of the Treaty of Detroit, based on a very sort of a landmark negotiation in 1950 between the auto workers union and the big three automakers. But it really spread much more broadly to the workforce. But that Treaty of Detroit basically eroded, and we instead had newer companies, like, for example, Walmart, the largest employer in the United States, non-union, really sort of pursued a low-cost strategy, and part of that low cost was paying a lower wage. And so to counter that, we need something else. And one of the things that we also have used is having a minimum wage. So this is an interesting contrast, because here in Sweden, there's no statutory minimum wage, but you have many floors. And we'll come back to this sectoral bargaining, which is another critical aspect, that sets standards for different places, different jobs. In the US, we have a federal minimum wage. And that federal minimum wage in the 50s, 60s, 70s also was updated fairly regularly. That stopped as well in 1980. So this goes back to the choices.
Everything bad happens in 1980. And if we look at what went on in the world back then, I think the Volcker shock, I mean, when the Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker raised interest rates really through the roof, I mean, higher than no one really had seen before, that's when you had this deep recession and a lot of people became unemployed. And when you're unemployed, you also leave the union. And I think I've heard, because the same thing was going on in the UK under Margaret Thatcher, that they raised interest rates. And one of the policymakers involved said that we basically created a reserve army of unemployed to sort of break the backs of the unions. So there's a lot of things that you can trace to this year, 1980, I think, when interest rates really rose. So would you agree with that? Is that?
Yeah. So the critical thing is, of course, just for listeners, that 1980, we had Ronald Reagan was elected and became the president in the United States. And there were a lot of important choices, policy choices that were made under that administration. One of them, for example, was not raising the minimum wage at all during the 8 years that he was the president. Another choice that not he directly, but yes, the Federal Reserve made was to raise interest rates very sharply. And not only to raise it sharply to, really kind of create large unemployment to bring down the inflation, but generally what followed after that was a period where we really stopped prioritizing full employment because of partly the fear that inflation is just around the corner, when in reality, a lot of inflation was also driven by sort of very particular supply shocks. And this is really ironic because we, I think, are reliving that moment today where, you know, we sort of are, you know, faced with the, you know, really difficult periods of inflation that are, you know, in big part caused by supply shocks. We focus on what can we do by reducing demand because that's something we can control. But that comes at very high cost, not only fewer jobs, that's important, but also it makes it harder to have broad-based wage growth. Mm. And that is exactly what happened in the 1980s. We had a multiple sources of pressure. We stopped raising the minimum wage. We had high unemployment. These really led to very poor real wage growth for the bottom, really like most of the workforce.
Mm. And the reason that you stopped raising the minimum wage, one of them, I think, was sort of a consensus forming in the economics profession that minimum wages are a distortion. It's actually, it's not only bad for the economy, it's actually bad for the workers themselves, because if you set a wage floor, some people will be below the line and they will be unemployed. So the minimum wages cause unemployment. That was sort of the consensus in the 1980s, right? And 90s, perhaps.
Yeah. And so the idea is very simple that, look, if wages are set by supply and demand and the government comes in and forces the wage to be higher, workers are priced out.
Yes.
That's it. And so, and that's a, you know, sort of an intuitive argument. It just turns out to be quite incomplete because when employers have some discretion in setting wages, they may choose not to raise the wage, even if it actually can recruit more workers and fill vacancies more easily, because while it could recruit more workers, may actually lead to a bit lower profit. So as a result, they may choose to hold back hiring by not paying as much. In that world, when the government comes in and says you have to pay a higher wage, businesses could actually recruit and retain workers more easily.
Mm.
It could actually, very counterintuitively, raise employment, not lower employment. And this is a critical insight that comes from richer models of the labor market that actually have become a lot more acceptable today in economics than it was 20 years ago.
Yes. And there are different explanations for why a minimum wage does not cause unemployment. There's what you talked about with having lower turnover, higher morale. It also leads to incentives to invest in more capital and to replace labor with machines. Then it raises productivity, which is good for growth and unemployment and employment. And also the fact, I mean, you can explain it within the theoretical model of the sort of the supply and demand curves, but just say that the labor market is not perfectly competitive.
Right.
And that's why there's some leeway there for companies to set higher or lower wages. But you can also say that raising the wage will cause higher demand. Let's sort of have a Keynesian explanation that if workers get paid more, they can also spend more. So they can spend more on other businesses that will then hire people, and newer companies will borrow money and invest, and you'll get a higher aggregate demand, and that will raise unemployment. So there are, as I see it, two different explanations, one perhaps supply side focused and one demand side focused.
Yeah. And the third one is that it may, you know, encourage more production and higher productivity companies. by reallocating workers. And that actually also is something that goes back to older Swedish tradition, the Rehnbjerg, you know, sort of
That's right.
setting model of the Hawaii, both a wage floor and also a tighter labor market can actually lead to a sort of more productive reallocation.
Exactly. That was the idea of the Rehnbjerg model, that you set higher wages that will force companies to be productive.
Yeah.
And it also force those companies that aren't productive to go bankrupt and leave the labor market. The idea was also kind of, it was a socialist idea in some ways, that you would raise productivity, but also increase capital concentration, because
yeah.
the bigger companies could afford to pay higher wages, and you would sort of weed out the small firms, and you would concentrate capital more and more in fewer hands, and then you could take over that concentrated capital. I mean, that's one explanation for it. So that was the Swedish model that we had in the 50s and 60s, perhaps. And in the US, you had minimum wages that you had in the 70s, but then you stopped raising them in the 80s.
That's right. And so that led to a very interesting, if that's the right word, situation. So, you know, just to sort of a backstory here is that the minimum wage literature has really paid a lot of attention to the United States. There are many reasons for that. But one reason is because we have a lot of different minimum wages by different states. And that really emerged in the 1980s. Because we stopped raising the minimum wage, states like California or Massachusetts started raising its own minimum wage. So today, though, we have a particularly stark contrast. The federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, and it has been $7.25 an hour since 2009. That was actually the last time I was in Sweden, or in Stockholm, I should say, and that was quite a long time ago.
Yeah. Does anybody get that pay, $7 an hour? Is that...
It is so low that virtually no one actually makes that, so which means that the federal minimum wage could just be zero. It would not really be different. In 20 states, that's the only minimum wage there is. So that means in 20 states, we basically have no minimum wage at all. In the other 30, we have actual state-level minimum wages and sometimes fairly high levels. To give one example, in California, the fast food minimum wage is $20 an hour. That turns out to be roughly 75% of the median the wage in California.
That's a good wage for working at McDonald's.
It's even higher in that way of measuring than here in Sweden for fast food workers. And so that, just to give you an example, we span an incredibly wide variation in what the minimum wage is.
So good setting to do research.
Yeah, terrible way to set policy. Great for people, nerds like me, who want to understand what's the causal effect of these policies. And we've ran this experiment for over a generation. So the data is there. We know exactly what happens when you do this.
That's interesting, because in the 90s, people started actually looking at the empirical situation.
That's
not only relying on theoretical arguments, oh, it will cause unemployment, but looking what actually happens when one state raises the minimum wage and another state doesn't.
Exactly.
What's the difference on that side of the border and this side of the border? And so tell us what happened with that research.
Yeah. So in 1992, New Jersey raised its minimum wage. The neighboring state, Pennsylvania, did not. So two economists, David Card and Alan Krueger — David Card went on to get the Nobel Prize a few years back in economics — well, they just had this idea, like, why don't we go actually look to see what happens in employment before and then compare it to after in one side of the border, New Jersey, and then the other side of the border, Pennsylvania. Doing this, they found something that was exactly contrary to the sort of dominant narrative of what the supply and demand model says. The supply and demand model is really clear. You should see lower employment. Exactly how much, we don't know, but it definitely should be lower. Turns out it wasn't lower. In fact, New Jersey had somewhat a little bit higher employment growth in fast food restaurants. And this really shook up the profession, but it led to actually something that's very healthy. It has led in part to an economics profession that is a lot more empirically minded, where, you know, when you're doing science, you have theories, but when the data is, you know, it does not support the theory, then you should reject it and find a better theory. And that's kind of exactly what happened. It was very conflictual. People, a lot of economists were very skeptical and some, you know, said very impolite things, yeah. Let's say. But over the years, it has led to a very much better reset of research agenda and a lot more work that and basically has verified the original Cardin-Kruger study. And we actually, in 2010, we published a paper looking at all the borders in the United States over a, you know, 16-year period, and asked exactly what happens when you just sort of replicate this in a much wider scale and over a longer time horizon. And we found basically exactly the same type of finding as Cardin-Kruger.
And this is actually a very encouraging story, I think, because sometimes you think of social science and economics as sort of a very ideological sort of endeavor that's not really scientific. And some people, well, in the beginning, there was sort of strong ideological reactions. This can't be true if the data is wrong. There's nothing wrong with the theory. The theory is perfect. The data is wrong. You've messed it up or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But eventually, people started changing their minds.
Yeah. And I think, you know, frankly, economics is a lot more empirical science today than it was when I went into, you know, the profession in grad school. I think there was a lot of strong reliance on theories, and some in those theories often were, yeah, reflected certain ideological biases, et cetera. It's very natural. It's all, we're just going to rely on our theory. It's going to reflect our biases. The question is not if you can avoid that, but the question is how do you correct for that based on data? And that is exactly what's happened more. I'm not going to say that the economics profession is all, everything is fine today, but it is a lot more empirically minded. Just even this week when I was at Uppsala and Stockholm University talking to a lot of the doctoral students who are doing research, young researchers, it's just very encouraging to see how much richer empirically minded way of trying to understand how wages are set, for example, you know, here in Sweden. That is the kind of thing that is going to really increase our understanding of the real world in a way that, frankly, wasn't happening like 20 years ago. Mm.
And there's another empirical natural experiment that happened, if we move on to the macro level, that happened in the 90s as well, relating to wages and unemployment. I'm thinking about the idea that there is a natural rate of unemployment, that unemployment can only go so low. It can only be like 6% before inflation starts taking off. If you try to lower interest rates or spend more money, if fiscal policy is more expensive and you try to lower unemployment that way, it won't work because you'll only start inflation. That was a very strong idea, I think, before the 1990s, but then something happened. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I think basically going back to our conversation earlier, after the Volcker shock, there was just a very strong desire to make sure that we don't have inflation come up. And so we got to just really err on the side of caution and keep unemployment rate, you know, higher. The natural rate, maybe 6%, maybe 5%, but certainly not lower. And that was incredibly costly. Mm. It turns out in the United States between 1979 and 2019, just prior to the pandemic, if you look at how much real wage growth there was, there were 7 years, only 7 years of relatively tight labor market. It was in the late 1990s and late 2010s. If you just somehow poof, like snapped your finger and those 7 years went away, you can ask, like, what would have happened to the real wage growth? If you're at the top, like the 90th percentile, your average wage growth after taking out inflation would have gone from maybe 1.1% to 1%. Not much change. In the bottom half, it would go from something like 0.3%, which is already low, to nothing. meaning the entirety of the wage growth in the bottom happened in 7 years. So then it becomes critical to understand where those 7 years come from, like in the late 1990s. Well, the Federal Reserve, the sets the interest rates in the United States, was again, in by mid-90s, late-90s, the unemployment rate was coming down for the first time. And it was 5%. Oh my gosh, inflation's any day now, right? Going to come around. We better start raising the interest rate today. Well, there was some pause, like, well, but it doesn't seem like inflation's rising. So maybe we should just let the party go on a little longer, you know, like,
because leave the punch bowl there.
Leave the punch bowl. So you got to take away the punch bowl, was like the sort of seen as the responsible thing to do. But it's responsible only to one side of the equation, not responsible to the livelihoods of millions of workers who are not seeing real wage growth. So actually, it ended up being the Federal Reserve allowed the late 2000s boom to continue. And that was one of the two, you know, periods where we actually saw real wage growth. That the learning of that was incomplete. It was again relearned in the late 2010s when we had another episode of, like, well, after spending a really long time with very high unemployment after the financial crisis, we finally started to have a tighter labor market. And again, like, well, maybe inflation is going to pick up. Well, inflation was under the target of 2%, and it stayed under the target of 2% even through 2019. And those last 2018 and 2019 were periods of actually broad-based and strong real wage growth. And so this is the critical thing. If we, you know, the market is not going to by itself always provide what we need in terms of broad-based wage growth. But if you, to the extent to which it does, relies on actually having a macro policy that allows the market to work well. Mm. And that's one thing that the United States actually has done better in the last 10 years. And that includes during, you know, in the aftermath of the pandemic. What's really interesting is when I was writing this book and I was going to write about the macro issue, something happened outside the window that was just fascinating to see. We saw a really tight labor market in 2021, 22, 23, which led to very sharp real wage growth, much stronger at the bottom than the top, which is just completely flips the script of the past 40 years. It actually reduced the increase in inequality in wages that had happened between 1980 and 2019, a third of that was reversed just from this tight labor market. We can't rely on that as the main or the only strategy, but it is absolutely a critical strategy. And it's important because the last 10 years, the United States has actually seen better wage growth, real wage growth after adjusting for inflation than both we had prior and compared to many of our peer countries. So that's one of the success stories. We have a lot of problems when it comes to wage growth in the United States, but that's been something that I think it would be worthwhile to consider, including here, you know, in Europe and Sweden in particular.
Yes, I think I have to explain it to the Swedish listeners and viewers that what a tight labor market is, because it's something that we really haven't seen in our lifetime almost. The last time we had it was in 1989 or 1990, when we had a big property boom that sort of went out of control. But then we had unemployment that was down to 1.5%, 2%, something like that. Everybody could get a job. But a tight labor market, that means that there is a lot of purchasing power going around in the economy, a lot of money to spend. People have money, or someone is spending money. There's a lot of demand, aggregate demand. Either you have a very expansive monetary policy or expansive fiscal policy, somehow you make sure that there's a lot of money going around in the economy, right? Is that the way to explain it?
Yeah. And that means that employers are really chasing workers. So vacancies are plentiful, workers are not. And that actually reduces that, remember that word monopsony, it reduces monopsony power. So it actually makes the market work better. In fact, it leads to workers moving to higher productivity companies. Again, going back to the Rain Meitner story. So we actually document this in our research, and I talk about it in my book, that we see beneficial reallocation of workers to higher productivity companies. So that actually means that not only are you paying higher wages because employers are paying higher wages for the same productivity, but you're actually also raising productivity. So that actually is a double dividend from a tighter labor market. And that's basically what we saw happen. The problem, of course, is that this was happening in the more recent period in a time of high inflation globally. And so this makes it hard to extract the signal from the noise, but it's critical that we do that because otherwise we don't understand that we could have had most of that inflation and not have wage growth. That would be sort of a bad. Instead, we were able to make sure we could raise real wages at the, you know, bottom and the middle more, even as we had a painful inflationary experience.
Yeah. And we don't actually, we don't need to go into the pandemic because, as you say, it's messy. There was inflation because of supply shocks. Maybe the fiscal response wasn't as targeted as it should have been or could have been in a different setting. But if we just stop at 2019, before the pandemic, unemployment, 3.5%, inflation, nowhere to be seen. The inflation that came later was because of the pandemic. It wasn't because the labor market was heating up and people were getting jobs. That's not why we had inflation.
Exactly. So I think like the idea that we want to allow that unemployment rate to fall and have tight labor market, and that can be a very healthy way of running the economy hot without really having the kind of worries, that lesson is critical, because without that, we are sort of relegating ourselves to a world where we're not letting the market actually do what it can in many ways to help broad-based wage growth.
And also, inflation came down without unemployment having to rise in the, in the U.S. There were some economists that said, oh, in order to get inflation down, we need to have 1 year of 10% unemployment, or maybe half an hour of 100% unemployment or something to get the inflation down. People using this very crude Phillips curve model, but that's not really what affects inflation, especially not in a supply shock.
So you know, it's called this, the sacrifice ratio. So there was, basically, I guess like either prediction or prescription, both really, of basically, let's do Volcker again. And thankfully, we did not. And
thankfully, those people weren't in charge that time.
Absolutely. And as a result, we had what's sometimes called immaculate inflation, disinflation, because we basically, the inflation came down, unemployment didn't rise. And, you know, that has, even today, in spite of a number of unfortunate choices made by our government, we still have a relatively, you know, tight labor market. There's a lot of, you know, headwinds, things that are not going well in many ways, and those are problems. But the fact that we've been able to keep relatively low unemployment rate for a longer period than in most of my adult life, and that's an important basis to build the wage standard.
And inflation is sort of ticking up now in the United States, but there's also a lot of other stuff going on. You have the tariffs. You have this crazy foreign policy where you create a global oil shock. So let's not dig into that too deep because we don't have time for that. It's a whole different conversation. But you said before that you switch the, by lowering unemployment, having a high pressure economy, you lower unemployment, you sort of switch the power balance. You turn it from a buyer's market, monopsony, into a more of a seller's market. And the seller is the seller of labor. The worker. You sort of even out the balance, and you can even make it so that workers can choose which job should I get. It's not that you have to stand in line to get one shitty job that's available. You can actually pick and choose. And that's what happened during the pandemic after this, the great reshuffling that you mentioned. You write about that people actually had been stuck in these low productivity jobs. They were not fulfilling their potential at all at work. Suddenly, when you had this environment where you had really high unemployment insurance, you get checks sent home to you, you could afford to be unemployed for a little while, you could afford to switch jobs, and demand was high, you could pick and choose, and you could move to a better job, and you could leave that other space that you had been to someone else that was completely outside the labor market. So this is something that I think is really important to get across, that lowering unemployment is not only good for those few percentages of people that are unemployed, it's actually good for everybody who can move up on the job ladder. It's good for productivity. It's good to get people who are outside, get them in the labor market. The black unemployment rate was lower than it had been for 50 years during this period.
Yeah.
So a high pressure economy is so much more than just that little.
That's one of the most important lessons I think that we really need to like digest is that, of course, it's good for those additional few percent of people who are getting jobs, but it is much broader than that. It is something that benefits everyone. It really allows for broad-based wage growth in a way that otherwise we're sort of, you know, holding back our ability to experience that, you know, shared prosperity.
Yeah. So if I would summarize it, I would say that we in Sweden, we have a long tradition of sectoral bargaining, strong unions, which is also good for inflation management, by the way. If you have a centrally coordinated wage, you don't get these wage price spirals, which allows you to actually run the economy hotter than you otherwise would.
Could, yeah.
And Sweden used to know this. We used to run a hot economy in the post-war years, but we forgot about that because we're still in this pre-90s period where we still think of there's a natural rate of unemployment that has to be 7.5%. That's the official figure, by the way. 7.5% that have to be unemployed. If it goes below that, you'll get inflation. We're still stuck in this pre-empirical era, I would say, with the economy. So I would say perhaps you in the US, you could learn something from the way we organize the MISO level with bargaining, unions.
Absolutely.
But we in Sweden could learn something about what you in America are doing at the macro level to run the economy hot and how important that is.
I think that's well put. I think we, you know, we're doing some experimentation in sectoral standards at the state level. We could learn a lot from Sweden and, you know, this the Nordic experience. I think what one thing, however, we have done, I think, in some ways better than many of our peer countries in the last 10 years is exactly that sort of prioritizing full employment. I hope we continue to do it. But I think I also hope to see other countries sort of prioritizing that and move away from sort of an austerity mindset.
Yeah, yeah, which is still very strong in Sweden and Europe. We here at the Catalyst, the union-funded think tank, we just published this book. In Swedish, it's called Den onödiga arbetslösheten, hur USA slutade oroa sig och började jobba, which could be translated to unemployment is unnecessary, how the United States stopped worrying and started working. And it's written by a young economist who was at the New School in New York and interviewed policymakers and economists in the US. He interviewed Jared Bernstein and Heather Boucher, J.W. Mason and Dean Baker about what are you doing in the US to lower unemployment? How do you see unemployment in the US and how does it differ from the way we see it in Sweden and Europe? And there's a good quote from Jared Bernstein there, President Biden's economic advisor. He said that he tends to think of European economists as sort of progressive in the micro, but not in the macro. And I think if we here in Sweden could learn to also be progressive in the macro, we could really start getting wages up and we could really start building an inclusive labor market that actually includes people and especially minorities that are now outside the labor market, ostracized. They are blamed for being unemployed, but if we could really learn to run the labor market hot, to have a more expansive fiscal policy, then we could build a more inclusive society, is how I see it.
It's a great note to end on.
Yes, thank you very much, Arian Duby, for coming.
My pleasure.
Du har lyssnat på en podcast från Aftonbladet. Ansvarig utgivare är Lotta Folker.